Hello. In this episode of AS for Architecture, Frank Jacobus and Brian Kelly talk about their book, Artificial Intelligent Architecture, New Paradigms in Architectural Practice and Production, published by Oro Editions in December last year.
AS for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of AS for Architecture. I'm talking today to Brian Kelly and Frank Jacobus. Thanks ever so much for joining me. We're going to be talking about your book, Artificial Intelligent Architecture, today. But perhaps before we do that, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself, maybe starting with you, Frank?
Well, hello, everybody. I'm Frank Jacobus. I have become the department head of architecture at Penn State University. I'm also co-principal of the firm Silo AR&D.
And what does Silo AR&D do?
We are an architecture firm that does residential work. We do some institutional work. We take on probably two or three projects a year. We've been around since 2014-ish. I partner with a fellow named Mark Manak, who teaches at UNC Charlotte.
Is it quite common for professors of architecture in the States to run practices at the same time?
I think I would say it's common that they do that. If you looked at the entire body of a faculty, I'm not sure you're going to see a high percentage of that faculty doing that because everybody has such different things that they do and things that they research. But of the practitioners on the faculty, I don't know what you'd say, Brian, but I would think that, you know, many of those practitioners on the faculty do have firms that they run on the side.
Yeah, I agree. I think of varying capacities. Some people are more just sort of like a research arm and use it as a way to explore certain things. And some people are more of a traditional practice. But yeah, I would say that it's fairly common. I'm an associate professor at University of Nebraska. I've taught in Missouri and California and then now at Nebraska since 2009. I'm a licensed architect and relative to the previous conversation, have a small practice that do work here and there.
Fantastic. So this book that we're looking at, Artificial Intelligent Architecture, Frank, you suggested perhaps that I had picked up one of your books from, I think it might have been Routledge previously. Mm-hmm. And we were going to talk about that. And you had made a suggestion that we talked about this one instead, which mm-hmm. I'm really grateful for because it's an area that the podcast hasn't really dealt with, but is becoming more and more pertinent to the way that we teach architecture and the conversations we're having with students, and even the way that I had one student come to me today to say, I've been doing some research around an essay she's writing for me, and I use ChatGPT to get suggestions on texts. All of the suggestions were awful, but But anyway, so it's this thing it's this big thing that's happening in the background. How did you get to this book? Like, where does this book come from in terms of your own scholarship and, I suppose, as a cooperative enterprise, this co-edited edition?
Well, yes, it's, in some ways that could be a very long story, but I'll give you the short version of the story first, and we can dig into it if we want to. But you know, we have a sort of friend group that we follow, all of us now, and so those of us who are on social media, which I would assume is most of us in some capacity or another. And I've seen a lot of work. I knew Brian and his work from conferences and from just meeting him over the years. But I also was a friend of his on Facebook and had seen that he was doing some work in artificial intelligence. I was doing work in artificial intelligence and pretty much brand new, because I think, you know, we were doing work in Midjourney, you know, a couple months after it comes out. So it was pretty much at the start of at least Midjourney. And we just got together and said, wouldn't it be great to do a project like this? There's going to be so many people asking different questions about what artificial intelligence does, what these new tools do. Now, people that we were talking to were in either using DALL-E or Stable Diffusion, but most of them, I would say, were using Midjourney and finding that the interface of Midjourney was just, you know, more accessible. And so we just decided, let's get a group of people together who are doing different work with this tool to both ask, what are they doing? Like, what are they interested in doing? Because it's kind of interesting when you think of a tool coming out brand new, what do people just naturally gravitate to? What are they choosing to do with it? But then also, what questions does this elicit in terms of what they might, or what we as architects might do with this in the future? And so Brian and I were both interested in these questions and knew enough people doing this work that we could gather a group of people and say, we can get some, put our heads together and make a book that's, that we knew was going to be like that Polaroid photograph, you know, like that old picture that, like, even by the time the book came out, and this is one of the reasons we worked with Oro, we needed to get the book out as quickly as possible because artificial intelligence was going to change by the time the book came out. But we're going to have a picture of this thing as it was when it was at its origin. And so that's part of the book's premise as well. So that, that was the background story to it. And we moved very quickly on it and gathered this group of people together and yeah, it came out well.
So the contributing authors from it are sort of agglomerated from your social media and, I guess, professional, but less professional.
Yeah, social media and also just asking people who we knew who were interested in this, who else should we be looking at? Mm. They weren't necessarily on our social media feeds, or I don't know, at least 50% of them I might have known tangentially, or I didn't know at all. And through word of mouth of reaching out to people saying, who should we be talking to for this? You know, to get 20 people, you're going to ask 30 or something like that, because not all of them are going to want to do it for various reasons. Whether some of them were scheduling reasons. You know, we wanted this thing out quickly. It needed to be out. I mean, I've forgotten the timeline, but we gave people maybe 2 or 3 months total to write a chapter. And so this had to be moving quickly. So some people just couldn't do it. But yeah, it was a matter of not just our network, but a network of a network and a network of a network of a network, that sort of thing. And then just looking at those, once we got these names, looking at the people's work and then and sorting it and saying, is there a diverse body of work here? Or are there a diverse set of questions that are being asked here that would make this book worthwhile and not just a kind of singular way of approaching this tool.
It certainly does, and you sort of organize it around themes as well, which makes it quite an easy read to book to read. I wonder whether any of your authors actually just got to that point a week before you wanted the submission and just got ChatGPT to write the paper for them. But
we would have welcomed it, Ambrose, as long as there was a lot of heavy editing after ChatGPT did its work.
Well, I think it's humorous to talk about, but at the same time, you probably noticed that we did interview Andrew Cudlitz for the introduction. And then in the conclusion, we actually interviewed ChatGPT the same questions, just because as a Polaroid, we thought it'd be interesting to see just how does ChatGPT answer these questions. And it was very, you know, at many places it was very predictable and also very non-confrontational. But it was trying to reflect where the technology's at and trying to get a sense of, you know, where it might be going.
It might be.
It was slightly frightening too, because it was, I found that the answers that ChatGPT gave were very close to the answers that Andrew Cudlitz gave. And so I don't know if that means that Andrew, this might be libel, but I don't know if that means that Andrew's a robot or if ChatGPT is getting more sophisticated than we want it to be. But it was kind of scary. And people who, I mean, I don't know, Ambrose, if you've used ChatGPT much, but I've used it a bit. And there is a lot of predictability in it, but there's also moments of, oh, that did help. You know, you have to kind of sift through the stuff that's you know, middle schoolish, and then there are certain things that really do help. And so, but yeah, we wanted to get that kind of mirror image of the human and the artificial intelligence tool and see how they compared to one another.
It's amazing. It is amazing. I had a brief interaction whilst picking up my children from primary school, spoke to a friend of mine who uses ChatGPT as a scholar in and around installation art. And I had this question around coding a certain, producing code to produce a certain product that I've been working on. And he typed it in, and within about a minute, he had a code that could be with some editing, would need some editing, but that could do what I wanted it to do. It was just ridiculous. Yeah. It was sort of scandalizing, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, the one of the courses I'm teaching right now, I just had Joshua Vermillion, who's also an author, and one of the chapters in this book, he came in and was talking about some of the ways he's using ChatGPT to generate visual scripting and ways that it's, you know, sort of tying. He had a really interesting presentation on how he tied it into historical art precedents and it was completely experimental, and there was times that he said it worked really great, and there's times that it absolutely failed. But it was interesting the way he actually like dialogued with it. He would write the code, or ask the ChatGPT to write the code, and then he'd say, it's not quite doing what I want it to do. Can you change it to this? And then it would write another code, and then he'd say, well, okay, that's better, but it's not doing this yet. And so it would then write another version of it. So it really was a kind of a dialogue interaction back and forth between him and ChatGPT, which then the visualization of it became the test of whether or not it was actually working and doing what, he was hoping for. So
I suppose we kind of throw the word around. What is AI? It's just seems like a rather silly question, but what are the mechanisms by which these programs like Midjourney, ChatGPT, and the others you've mentioned, what are the mechanisms by which they operate? How do they work? You download them from the internet and you say stuff to them. But I mean, what is the architecture behind it? Is it like just an incredibly sophisticated search engine with a relatively realistic voice?
Well, I think that, Frank, you can jump in here if you need to, but I don't think that Frank and I are the people that are going to answer your question about exactly the
black box
of AI. I mean, it's it's definitely something that, for me, I'm actually comfortable with that. I don't feel like I need to know how to write the sort of black box behind it. I'm coming into it, and I think that's part of maybe this first generation of users. Frank kind of alluded to this earlier, but people are bringing, because it was a new tool, people were bringing into it, you can call it baggage or ideas or whatever it may be that were probably at least formulated or certainly had a certain degree of formulation to it outside of the time that they were working in AI. So for me, I've got, certain interests I'm trying to bring into it. Frank has got certain interests he's bringing into it. And that's kind of what I felt was interesting as well about these chapters, is that, people were talking about how they're almost appropriating ideas that they had and using this as just another tool to maybe realize that or explore it. And it's just giving them, different ways of understanding what that might mean. So, I think, we've had chapters in there about prompt craft and things like that, about ways that you can use language to get closer to realizing or visualizing something that a concept you might have or whatever. And I think that this is something where, the tool in and of itself, at least in my opinion, it's not thinking on its own, independent from our interaction. And so, what we bring to it, I think, is the sort of the subjective that is helping to hopefully bring a level of curation or a level of directionality to it, even though there's a certain degree, we can talk about that more, but there's obviously issues of control, whether or not you are in control of things or if there's things that it's directing on its own. But mm-hmm. I found that for me, I'm trying to find many ways to at some levels trip it up and to find ways to provoke it to do things that it doesn't want to do. I mean, one of my interests in that regard is error. And, I'm interested in trying to find ways. And actually the version 3 of, 2 or 3 of Midjourney at some levels is a little bit better for me because it messed up more. And I found some really kind of interesting opportunities in those errors where, version 5 now is getting more and more precise, and you can't get an image, it's working towards producing exactly what it thinks you want. And for me, I still want to engage the authorship in that. And the error allows me a place where, I can kind of intervene into, sort of filling the gaps where it doesn't maybe make sense what it's doing.
Yeah, over the years talking to, I have colleagues who are, who would say that they're PhDs whose research is artificial intelligence or generative design. And I've talked to them about these tools over the years, and it just kind of, it's not that none of these people cross over, but oftentimes there's people who know how to make the tool, but they don't know what to do with it. And there's people who don't know how to make the tool, but they have all kinds of ideas as to what to do with it. And I fit into that second category of people. I'm interested in what these things are and how they're made to a certain extent, but I'm more interested in making work with the tool.
Question I pose to you is the kind of lineage of this moment, this extraordinary, possibly paradigm shifting moment. And I guess the reason I ask about the sort of architecture that underpins the artificial intelligence software is it seems to be to me a different order of tool. You've described it in a way, you as tool users, but it seems, and a lot of what I pick up from the book, the different examples that are given, it's a totally different way of conceptualizing a tool. It's a tool with a mind. It's not like a drill, someone, you know, you've got a brace and bit versus a battery-powered cordless drill. They're doing the same thing. The logic is the same. There's a battery in one, and there's human. But fundamentally, we know what it does, kind of. And I suppose I'm interested in the idea of the way AI seems to represent this paradigm shift in the actual fabric of design itself. Like it's not like design as we understand it, design which has this kind of, which we've been teaching in universities now for a long time, decades and decades, has this kind of process to it. Sometimes it's very frustrating, that process, where you know you do a bit of context analysis, you do a bit of environmental analysis, you do a little pop-up prototype thing, and then you move from that to a big thing, and that's the design process in architecture. This is totally different, and I am kind of interested in what that represents and how that actually functions.
Well, I think that one thing I would maybe say to that, though, is that I guess my position on it being a tool is that, you know, I'm engaging it in, you know, it's part of one of the ways in which, you know, you might explore things. And even with my students, I'm working in a collaborative design studio right now, and there's teams of four students. And I mentioned to them that because we're using some of these tools within the design process, that it's, you know, that sometimes it's a fifth team member, because it's going to throw ideas in. You got to negotiate whether or not it's a good idea or bad idea. And but they're also still directly alongside that, literally making, you know, physical models and sketches, and they're doing, you know, as you said, environmental analysis, and they're doing, you know, they're working with parametrics and things like that. But I think for me, it's not necessarily that, you know, it's just not my wheelhouse of knowing how to write the software, but I do, you know, have certainly opinions about how the content is being used. You know, for instance, the models that are being trained to develop this AI. And how it has, you know, I think it's even been mentioned in the book where, you know, it has certain bias to it. It has certain stylistic affinities that it might have. It, you know, based on what it is trained with, that's what it knows. And so, you know, I'm interested in from that regard and what it, you know, there's times that you might reference in, you know, for instance, in Midjourney, you might reference an artist that's maybe a bit more obscure. And there might not be much information in the model that's being trained relative to that, and it doesn't really understand what to do with that piece of information. Whereas, you know, you use something that's more well known, and it's going to respond in a way that, you know, is very predictable. And actually, I think quite pedestrian in the fact that it just becomes sort of like what everybody else is doing, which I think for me is less interesting, and I think for Frank as well.
Sort of like the early days of search engines, where the information that was provided through the search engines was really diverse and often very odd. And as search engines have become more sophisticated, actually what one encounters through internet searching is less and less sophisticated, less and less kind of diverse. But do you have any sense of where this moment has come from? Like, what is the backstory to this, other than the software itself and the work of programmers and coders? For architecture, have we been building towards this moment? Has this been something that there's been an apparent appetite growing for, or even embedded in historical discourse?
I think there has. I love that prompt you gave us. I think it's you know, this may sound hyperbolic, but I think this sort of path that we're on is the path that we've been on since we could put it all the way back to the moment we gained the ability to think abstractly about our world. I mean, this is just, this is on the same path and line. It's not the same thing, but it's on the same path and line as parametricism. It's on the same path and line as us attempting at mechanisms of control in our environment. This is the same path that we've been on the whole time. And these tools are different in some respects, but they follow those same rules. How do we sort of ask questions and get the answer delivered to us as quickly as possible and in ways that we can control? And this is what we've been trying to do in Revit, and this is what we've been trying to do in Rhino Grasshopper. And Brian and I have talked about in the past, you know, for all the criticism that's out there with AI tools, which we should talk about, and we should be critical of what's happening. Nobody ever seems to say one of the values of it is that it opens up a process of work to people who may be left out, like, for instance, parametric design, so difficult to access for so many people. There's a long learning curve. AI's got a short learning curve to be able to produce work. Now, whether that's good work or not, that's something we can talk about, but you can produce work. You can bring work into the world. Whereas if you give somebody a parametric tool, you have to have a lot of background in this to even produce anything. And so I think future tools, I would think the pathway is, and you know, Negroponte and Cross and others are talking about this in the 60s, even, that the ultimate goal is that we are communicating verbally with something and it's delivering things to us in real time. Mm-hmm. The interface is the problem, right? Like, I don't know what buttons to click in such and such a tool. This is a problem. We know what to say, and oftentimes we don't know what we desire, but as a designer, let's say you know what you desire. Why is it so difficult to achieve that desire with these tools? And so I think the tools are going to evolve to help break down the barrier of entry and the barrier of how difficult it is to produce a work, how long it takes to produce the work. And this is just another in the line of that evolution.
I think that comparison is really great, Frank, with the difference between them. But I think also one of the things that's interesting to me, and you and I have been around long enough to see the pendulum swing a few times, but it seems to me that there, with parametricism and with AI, there's this very quick critique about it just makes a bunch of stuff. And, you know, there's not really any kind of evaluating of the content. It just sort of pushes things out. And so, you know, I remember them talking about a definition and it would crank out, you know, multiple versions of what a building form might be. And so then you start to have a conversation about, like, well, which one's good and which one's bad. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. The same conversation we're having now, that, you know, it's an embarrassing amount of images that I've created in the last year and a half. And it's, you know, it's a situation where all of those images aren't good. And we're still in a place where curation is super important. The ability to know, or at least have a filter of getting a sense of what works and what doesn't work. And I think that's definitely something that's in this lineage as well. The ability to make an appropriate decision of what I oftentimes call the could versus the should. You know, there's a lot of things we could do, but what should we do?
Yeah, I think that's great. Yeah, and it brings up all sorts of questions to that effect. I mean, the idea that something can be good. I mean, there are people that question this, that wonder whether there is such a thing as good. Like, I believe that there is such a thing as a honed sensibility, let's say. If I state that here publicly, not everybody agrees with this. Not everybody would share this view that there is such a thing as a good sensibility, an average sensibility, and a bad sensibility. AI brings this to the forefront because you have a billion images. How do you know which one is the one that you want to move forward with? And the only way I know how to know that, it's almost like you're a DJ when you're in this tool, right? The only way I know how to do that is intuitively. You're just feeling it. You're feeling what's next. And the only way I know how to feel something is through my own sensibility of what I want to see in the world. And so AI brings that to the forefront. If you say there is no such thing as good, there is no such thing as having a refined sensibility, then AI does something different, right? But if you think there is good and you're trying to track it, AI gets you something very quickly and you're just intuiting your way to the next and the next and the next and the next, right? And maybe a kind of flaw in it is you need time to reflect, and it doesn't give you a ton of time to reflect. So you have to do that yourself. You have to push the pause button and reflect yourself, because you can get that stuff out as fast as you want it out.
And oftentimes, I mean, I don't know if you have gotten the sense as well, Frank, but for me, oftentimes it might be 10, 15% of the image that for me is something that I find that there's something there, and it's a sort of breadcrumb I'm willing to chase. But there's, you know, very few times am I getting a complete image out that is hitting the mark. It's more of that it's catalyzed something, and it's encouraging me to chase that a little bit further.
So
I bet you. Well, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, so with this process, say, for example, you produce these thousands of images and you found a percentage of them are good. I would like to understand, how do we measure good in relation to this? But as a tool, do you then say, well, I like the 15% of this image? How do you then input this? Like, what do you say to the AI to maintain that 15% and enhance the bits? Or do you go, I'll just try something totally new. I'll just try, you know, is it almost like Tinder? You know, it's just like swipe right, swipe left. It's like, this is an honest question.
I'm not sure about the answer to that.
I have never been on Tinder. I would just like to say that.
It's for me, I mean, it's maybe an unspoken thing between the tool and myself, where I'm, you know, I might find, you know, a certain portion of the image that is interesting to me, and I'm just going to continue to chase that and see where it goes.
Okay.
And so I'm, you know, it might be that I focus in, and I'm trying to find ways to trip the machine up a little bit. So if, as an example, I might find a piece of it that's interesting, I might crop it down to that, or I might find a way to combine that image with something else post-processed in, you know, Photoshop or something like that. A lot of the times this is something on the phone, so I might be just even collaging images together and then reprocessing them back into there. And so just finding various ways to, either let it go, take its course a little bit further, because there's a lot. I mean, I use this term that I'm breaking it. Like, I take it to a point where the sort of chain of images just seems like it's broke, and it's not going to produce anything anymore. That's, at least for what I'm interested in, it's not going to produce anything I'm going to continue to chase. But, you know, find ways to sort of trip that up, about reverse engineering it, or finding ways to, like I said, recrop it, reprocess it. I love the describe command in Midjourney to reverse engineer the way that they see, the way that the AI sees the prompt, because it'll tell you then, and oftentimes it'll give me a reference, or it'll give me a way of describing it, and maybe build my vocabulary in a way that it starts to understand what that is. And so I'm continually using those kind of tools to try to get it closer to where at least I'm trying to explore something.
Yeah, and I bet you there's a different answer to this question. I mean, there's going to be some commonalities, but a different answer per designer, because it is a tool that you're going to follow. You're going to use processes that are really about how you think and work individually, right? So I agree with Brian that I have had moments where I will recrop an image. I'll have moments where I blend two images that are distinct, but they have qualities in them that I like. But I go into Midjourney typically without a very definitive thing in mind that I want to see. Like, I don't have a definitive image. I might have a definitive idea, but not image, because I found that when I go in with a definitive image that I want to see, it's very difficult for me to get that image. But when I go in with an idea and I leave myself open to what could be, what's coming out of this tool, and I'm kind of reacting to it, then I find that I'm in a better place for that. And the tool also sometimes will give me something that I absolutely do not want, and that's the best thing that I ever got, right? It's like the thing that I didn't ask for, didn't want, but it was better than the idea that I had. And so I'll move with that. So I think if you go in with a free spirit to it, then you know, But you do have to hone. I mean, people misjudge this tool, by the way. I've heard a lot of this, like, it's just easy in an image generator. Yeah, you can generate images very easily with it. But if you are sensitive to what you're finding and seeing, you'll spend, I know Brian probably say the same thing. I could find myself in a tool like Midjourney for 5 hours and not even notice. You know, it's just, I'm in it, producing thousands and thousands of images. And then finally that one is the one that I was looking for. And so it also takes patience and will to get these things. And so it's, I don't find that as a design process, I spend less time because I have Midjourney. I just find that it gives me things and lets me refine things in ways that a different design process wouldn't allow me to do.
Mm. One of the themes I picked up in the book, and Sarah Asif's paper, essay in the book, is indicative of that, but I think it permeates a lot of the discussions and certainly a lot of the imagery that one sees associated with AI generation is around nature. And Sarah Asif calls it emulating natural forms, which I think I find this kind of interesting. And I was talking to my students, not in relation to this book and not in relation to AI at all, actually, but about the way that architecture has often, or architectural discourse has often sort of preferenced nature as the kind of ideal. But I'm interested that so much of AI seems to be, or AI generated imagery that I've seen as a proviso, seems to be pursuing quote unquote organic forms. What is that about? I guess I'm kind of intrigued by this. Is this the kind of the consequences of parametricism at the heart of the AI revolution, or is it something else?
I think it's a combination of things. It kind of eke it out here by just talking about it. I think, in part, you're able to make forms that that gravity does not affect them, and materiality and the way we assemble things, if we're talking about buildings in this case, because we're architects, that we're not bound to things as they need to be constructed in order to be made. Now, I do think, as a side note, this is one of the values that AI is going to bring, is we're going to be given forms now that fabricators, there's going to be a whole new world of fabricators finding ways to make things that are things that we didn't think we could make before. Anyway, but you're in this mode where you have these natural forms, you can produce imagery using them, and you're not bound to building them. I also think there's just a whole lineage of biomimicry and people who have thought in these ways before, and now they have a tool to be able to pursue that kind of approach to architecture. So there's many people out there saying if biomimicry might be a sustainable way to approach new buildings, maybe AI, because it's understanding certain things about the forms of these biological structures, that it can give us something that would also be that would be beneficial in this way. But it's also an intelligence, so it does what we do, which is to say that we mimic things. That's we're very good mimickers as human beings, and so it's doing that. And we're in, whether we call it nature or organic surroundings or whatever we want to phrase it, we're in that environment. And so we're going to mimic it in some way. We're going to react to it and imitate it in some way. And I think this is a natural reaction for people to use this tool in this way.
I think it's also a continuation or a mirroring of what we saw with the sort of digital transition, early 2000s, 90s into the early 2000s, with a lot of parametric forms and digital forms. We're also looking into this idea that we're very similar to biomimicry. And I think that what happened with that is that there were people that got tired of it looking like nature, but were transitioning to maybe looking at it performing more like nature, because there was more, we found that even though it looked like nature, it didn't actually perform that way. And so as a result, there's a move with biomimicry to try to transition it to being more performative in a way that it actually, responded in appropriate ways to maybe biosystems or whatever it may be. I think we're seeing that with AI image generation as well. It's at its infancy, and it's just natural that it's going to want to try to make things that look like that. But you know, hopefully that's something that will also just transition in the same way that it did before, where we start to get beyond, I would say, the spectacle that's there right now. You know, because it's, you know, there's certainly a lot of people, I think, that if you can produce an image like that, that looks like a rendering of a very complex, you know, geometrically complex building, and do it in a matter of, you know, 1 minute, you know, it's pretty interesting, right? And I think once you get past that, hopefully, you know, there's a lot deeper of a process that starts to understand what the potential of that is, besides it being something that's, you know, just simply, it just looks like, you know, a flower, or it looks like, you know, something else from nature.
I wonder whether there is some kind of basis here for the ethics of this design within this field. I think perhaps normative design practices are shot through with an ethical perspective, which controls to a certain degree how design is done. Like, we have this idea of civic responsibility. It permeates all our design, and we critique aspects of architecture for not taking seriously their obligation to the urban realm or context or history or heritage, whatever it is, people. And I wonder whether this drift towards nature somehow also is something to do with the tendency towards sustainability, ecological thinking in architecture, that this will become the kind of building block for an ethical perspective in this new design model. Like, we have to control it some way. This will be the device, and we will say we will be organic, and the architecture will come from that. And as you say, the fabricators will follow suit. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. It makes me think of, and I'm not a historian, but it's a way that I've always thought of the Art Nouveau movement, and, you know, this time period where technologies are on the rise, and there's both a reaction to, for, and against simultaneously, right? There's this desire for, we have the ability to make things in new ways, and the things that we make begin to be more organic in nature, like as in Art Nouveau. And so it could be that kind of thing you're talking about there, where there is this gravitation towards, with a tool that seems so, in some ways, I guess to some, so anti-natural, anti-organic. I don't know. It's strange that it would be an intelligence yet be anti-organic or anti-natural. It seems like it is organic and natural to the extent that it is an intelligence. But I see a kind of a parallel between what's happening now, perhaps, in a period in time like Art Nouveau.
Mm. The issue around design, and you've talked about that and explained in a small way, I suppose, your own practice, or briefly in your own practice as designers, how you use this tool. What becomes of the voice of the architect designer in this? Who does the architect become through this? And because I'm really interested in the issue of authorship, which we're like our whole sort of approach to historiography and even teaching design, we focus on these people and the work that they produce. But now we're talking about a machine taking a lot of the slack. But then you've also talked about the need to curate and mediate this process very, very carefully. So it becomes kind of difficult. And then the other question for me as an educator is, like, how on earth do you teach good taste in relation to these things?
Mm-hmm. Or as I said earlier, I believe it does, but I'm also 50 years old and probably out of touch in many ways at this point. But I believe sensibility and taste do exist. But I've talked to colleagues who would argue that they don't. Brian will probably be a better answer to the question of authorship. I would say one quick statement from me is that I would question where authorship arises, even in non-AI practices. So in other words, a lot of the arguments I've heard suggest that AI is simply using the work of other people and then generating new work based on that. And my question to those people who say that is, how has work been created in the past that's any different than that? We are always using the work of the people before us and of the environments around us to generate new work. That's what we do as human beings. Like, it's not just some sort of accident that there were many cubist painters, or that cubism evolves into other forms of expression in art. And we borrow from each other. And we, like I said earlier, we mimic and we imitate each other. And to me, these are beautiful things. I think, Ambrose, the crux of the question to me is, what does this start to generate? Like, it starts to, I think, bring up questions of sensibility, which are tough questions, but these tools bring up those questions. I also think it brings up questions of form. This is where my sort of research heart lies, let's say, and it brings up questions of form's performance in the world. And I think we discount form's performance in 2023, we are discounters of form's performance in the world. We believe in the social good, let's say, as we should, but we don't realize that form is the seed for all of that. The forms we make in the world either allow or disallow these kinds of social engagements, interactions, and human wellness that we experience. And so AI will bring up these questions. It'll always bring up the authorship question, but I would argue we've been borrowing from people's work forever. That's what we do.
100%. It's a practice of architecture in the same way that it's the practice of medicine, practice of law. I mean, in the US, we're a common law situation. And so, you know, law precedent informs new precedent, which, you know, there's not a distinct answer to that. And so in the same way, you know, that's what I think Frank and I, and I'm sure you as well, teach students, is that you've got to understand how to attack a problem with understanding the issues that are there for it, and then starting to find ways to kind of work within that. And that there's not, even if it's the exact same program, it may not be the same site, it may not be the same budget, it may not be the same client, it may not be the same climate. There's all kinds of different factors that are different for it. For me, the use of this tool has really been a lineage of development relative to my interest in authorship. I wrote some of our initial courses here in design thinking, which, you know, is obviously a collaborative tool that's used for helping design process. I then kind of transitioned in looking at open source design, looking at ideas of mass customization, and then looking even further into ideas of copyright law, and then most recently into, you know, into this AI. And so for me, again, it's just a situation where it's a tool that we're using, and it's another way of expressing ideas, and that it definitely has issues relative to ways that it uses content and the ethics of that. And not only from the standpoint of who owns the content, but also what diversity or spectrum of pieces are in it that it's being trained by. I know that there was in the beginning, you know, there's people that were doing cert or doing, you know, image generation, and it was always bringing out a very normative, simple answer that was based on, you know, certain biases that were in the model that as it was trained. And I think that we're, you know, we've identified those, and I think that there's ways to continue to broaden that. You know, information that's being brought forward into new content. But, you know, I completely agree with Frank that it's a situation where we've been using precedent for years, and you can argue that it's been being used in different ways, that we're not literally taking precedent. And then, but I think actually there are some of that happens. I mean, there's ways that, you know, you learn from a building and the way that, for instance, a circulation pattern works or strategizes its, you know, its connection to the site, or maybe a material strategy and connections and details or things like that. I mean, we're borrowing things, and, you know, folk music used to be, and I think still is probably, I'm not a music historian, but, you know, it was a situation where there was a lot of sharing back and forth with lyrics and music riffs and things like that. And it was meant as a way to kind of build on the predecessors of things that were there before. I think that it's, you know, now that being said, I'm not trying to dismiss, the intellectual property and the ethical sort of use of content. I think it's at some levels for me, I've kind of compared it to, you know, Napster in early 2000, where copyright law just couldn't catch up. It had to, it's always in the mode of catching up. And so it had to find ways to deal with digital music and sharing music and things like that. But there was a bit of a rogue territory there where people were downloading all kinds of music and
happy days.
It was a challenging time, and there was all kinds of litigation that then led to things like, you know, Apple Music or Spotify or whatever it may be, Pandora. And I think that there's, you know, a lot of musicians. And again, I'm not a musician and I can't really speak to this, but I think I've heard that there's a lot of people that say that maybe it's not fair the way that the amount of money or the way that royalties are taken care of in that situation. But I think that AI right now is in a situation where, you know, there's a bit of a rogue territory. And I think that there's people that are trying to find ways to respond to that, and everything from litigation to, you know, just finding ways to train the models better to give credit where credit is due, I guess.
I wonder if there will be, because I know when you're taking photographs of buildings or artworks for books, you often have to pay copyright fees, even if you only accidentally document someone's work. I remember helping write a book around church architecture, and there happened to be in the interior shots some stained glass windows by a modernist stained glass window maker, and it really wasn't the subject of the picture, but we had to pay copyright fees to the estate of that particular artist. And I wonder whether there will come a point where actually AI generated images have to show their constituent parts. And like Spotify, there's a kind of aggregational incremental payment model, like 0.1 cents for, you know, if it's 2% Zaha Hadid and then 0.2%. It doesn't seem impossible. It doesn't seem impossible, and possibly it wouldn't be unacceptable. Just as you were saying with music, if there's a riff that seems to be derived from another person's song, royalties have to be paid.
Yeah, I think that it would have to, I mean, each one of those cases, the difficulty is that, you know, when you, you know, in the case of the window, or when you play somebody's music, it's very clear that that music is by a certain artist and it's been done before. But with some of this imagery, the exact duplication of where that came from isn't there.
No.
And so, you know, I think that there's this copyright terminology of significant similarity. And oftentimes that's what court cases are determining. Is it significantly similar enough that it could be considered infringing? And that doesn't have to do with a percentage, like 5% of it is the same, and so therefore it's not similar, and then 95 means it's significantly similar. It has to do with a sort of novice view on it, and whether or not somebody sees it and thinks that it looks too similar to something else. And so I think that those kind of evaluations, which I guess, you know, you could argue that probably AI, in the same way that it's being used to evaluate medical imagery, as an example, to determine whether or not there's something happening that needs to be, fixed in the body or whatever, maybe AI will also analyze these images and determine exactly where these things come from and say that, yeah, like you said, maybe this is 2% Zaha and this is, you know, 1% Lebius Woods. And I'm naming a couple that have been used a lot in these tools. You know, they're referenced all the time.
I want to come to a point, Frank, that you just touched on there, which was this issue around form. And in your chapter in the book, you talk about it. I think it struck me as being, in a way, again, to come back to this issue around the ethics of what this technology and this mode of production might do, about reconnecting people to the immediacy of form making. And you've a very interesting kind of point you make around the meaning of form, and that form is that which both represents our meaning making, but also helps us make meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me that there's something akin to Martin Heidegger's ideas in building dwelling thinking around the way that this technology might enable us to, perhaps paradoxically, being that it's an abstraction, a tool of abstraction, but it might help us become centered and grounded in a kind of relationship to our built environment that's more immediate and more real, which I think is a wonderful way of, if I get you, is that basically what you're saying? Or is that something like what you're saying?
Yeah, I have a. I think we misconstrue form generally, and I tend to, because I love thinking about it and writing about it, I get into these conversations a lot, and sometimes I wonder how far off I might be in my thinking, but you know, not to get into the weeds of where these ideas are coming from. Heidegger certainly would be one reference. Forms, we tend to think that ideas originate forms. This is our common way of thinking. We have an idea, and then we make a form as an architect or as a painter or as a designer. And we've forgotten the first step. We have a form which gives us an idea, which allows us a form. We exist in a world of forms. We existed in a world of forms before the built environment was so pervasive, and we reacted and interacted with those things, and that's where ideas are generated. And so we tend to have this feeling that ideas come first, and especially in academia, where we are what I call lovingly smarty pantses. So we're intellects, and so we think deeply about these things, but we are also form makers and as architects. And there is that thing that we sense that's right and good, that space that we walk into that fills our soul. This is not a thinking thing. This is a feeling thing. And we, as intellects, we want it to so badly to be a thinking thing, but it originates with form. And I think the AI tools for me have been this magical place of just, there's nothing in the way. It just so quickly generates things that I can react to and know in my gut whether this is the right path forward. And it gets into, strangely, AI could be seen as this totally disembodied thing, but it gets into all these ideas of embodiment that I'm personally interested in. It has a power in that way that if one believes deeply in form and forms action in the world, the AI tools is mesmerizing in this way, because it just delivers this stuff to you over and over again. And so I don't know if that made any sense, but yeah, I think the way I've moved through these tools, I think it's helped me that I care deeply about what form does in the world, and have been in these constant debates about form and thinking and the sort of relationship between the two.
That's wonderful. Brian, do you have any thoughts around this area of the possible kind of value in this form making, that the value of generating an immediacy, and what that might do in terms of, I suppose, as practitioners? Like, obviously, in the world of academics and in the world of education and perhaps in the world of social media, there is an appetite for this. Is there similarly in the world of practice, is there going to be a crossover value to this kind of work, this kind of software?
I mean, I think that there's, I saw a presentation recently where there are all kinds of, it's a space right now for a lot of startups where they're developing AI tools to, there's people that are in offices and they notice that there's a task that they have to do that is cumbersome and that is, just maybe not the most desirable thing for them to do. Mm. And so they're finding ways to expedite that and to automate it in a way that is, intelligent, hopefully. And so I think that there's, we're finding a large amount of young practitioners that are taking a different route with professional practice and trying to develop tools that are automating certain things or expediting or, creating better, for instance, code analysis and things like that, where maybe it's starting to look at things and try to find ways to better understand the situation and maybe create, again, less error. There's plenty of times that, you submit a set of drawings or something like that, and there's, you might have missed a certain code or there's a certain requirement that you didn't quite have. And so I think that there's definitely, that's one of the places where I see that this is going to be not only a way that it changes practice, but also a way that it changes the way that the practitioner engages with the profession. And that, you know, there's still going to be plenty of people that are going to kind of take maybe a traditional route and move into an office and, you know, produce buildings. But I think it's also in some degrees opening up a new space for entrepreneurship and creating new tools that do new things.
Fabulous. Well, it's a great point to finish on. Thank you very much, Frank. Thanks very much, Brian. That's wonderful to talk to you, and great book.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ambrose. Appreciate it.
We're charging our battery, and now we're full of energy. We are the robots, we are the robots, we are the robots. Well, after this episode, I'm no longer so convinced by that argument, Kraftwerk. Thanks to Frank and Brian for clarifying things, and to Oro Editions for the PDF. Links to the book and to the gentleman are in the podcast description, of course. Thanks for listening.